Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, where we're always learning. For instance, I just learned by listening to the BBC that some British people pronounce migraine, migraine. I never knew that. I knew about the truck and the lorry thing, the lift and the elevator, never the migraine. Aluminium, sure, not migraine. On today's show, on the Brian Lehrer Show, not that old show, we'll hear an argument that the media helps mass shooters by publishing details of crime lines. That's right in advance of the Newtown Massacre. The one-year anniversary is tomorrow. We will get the latest on the Volcker Rule and why the Obama administration thinks it can change the way banks do business without Congress's help. We'll talk about photo sharing sites like Instagram, what they're doing to our memories. But first, let's talk about the ongoing crisis in Syria and what's looking more and more like a serious, at least confusion, if not miscalculation, about who the U.S. backed, the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. And here is what we know about the latest in Syria. Earlier this week, an Islamist group called the Islamic Front took control of the warehouses where supplies were being stored by the Free Syrian Army. That was the group that the U.S. had been backing in their fight against Bashar al-Assad. In response, the U.S. suspended aid to the Free Syrian Army in order to stop it, the aid from getting into the wrong hands. Also this week, Assad's military has won a series of victories around Damascus and the second biggest city in Syria, Aleppo. And there are, of course, millions of refugees who continue to be stranded in camps inside and outside the country as severe winter storms batter the area. Amnesty International called Europe's response to the refugee crisis, quote, shameful. That's just about all we know. Beyond that, it's extremely complicated and opaque. Let's see if we could shed some light on the deepening divisions within the opposition. Ask if the U.S. can do anything, if there are good choices about who to support. Liz Sly is Beirut Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. I don't know if Liz is with us yet. Hello, Liz.
Hello, yes. Hello, nice to be here. Thank you.
Yes, you're joining us from Lebanon, and thank you for joining us. And Josh Landis writes the influential blog called Syria Comment. He's the chair of Middle East Studies Department at University of Oklahoma. Hello, Josh.
How are you?
Good to
be with you.
Yes. Liz, let's start off with you. What's the latest on the fracturing of the opposition? There was, of course, never a unified rebellion to begin with, so that's why people were very wary of intervening from the beginning. Is what we're seeing now just confirmation of that wariness?
Well, yes, the opposition has been fracturing for pretty much since the beginning of the uprising against Bashar al-Assad. There has never been a unified opposition, and it has continued to evolve and mutate, and there's still multiple different groups. But what we're seeing right now actually is a sort of coming together, finally, if you like. And it's coming together around the Islamists more than it is around the secular groups that the U.S. has backed. And so where we stand right now is there are basically three groups. There's the secular group that the U.S. originally backed. They're kind of moderate, but they're rapidly losing influence, and they lost control of their whole warehouse full of supplies earlier this week, as you pointed out. And then on the far end of the spectrum, you've got the al-Qaeda-linked extremist Islamist groups that the U.S. calls terrorists. And then in the middle of that, you've got some other Islamist groups who are pretty Islamist in their outlook, but they're not linked to al-Qaeda. And they are the ones who seem to be sort of merging together and forming themselves as the biggest single block of opposition to Bashar al-Assad.
And so going in, was it always the least likely option that the group the U.S. would have liked to have gain the most influence, the secular groups would be the group with the most influence? It seems that, you know, as you describe the striations there, that the Islamists who could play both sides of the coin would have some sort of natural advantages.
Well, I think the moderate groups would argue that if the West had given them more support in the first place, they might have ended up as the most powerful group. But as it is, the countries of the Gulf have given most of their support. They've given much more support than the West has given, and that has gone to these sort of middle centrist Islamist groups, and that's why they're the strongest one. I think you actually can just look at where the money's gone to see who is the most powerful.
Josh, the U.S. has suspended non-lethal aid, non-lethal assistance. What's the distinction? Is there lethal aid that the U.S. is supplying, or is the non-lethal aid so that some other we could say we care? The U.S. could say they're keeping their hands clean.
Well, there has been non-lethal aid from the beginning, and we've given over $1 billion in aid to the Syrian opposition and other things. But we don't know about the lethal aid. Obama, in May or June of this year, said he was going to begin giving lethal aid. That meant training people and so forth. They refused to say whether any of our lethal aid were in those. But they don't say that there wasn't any. They just say that they can't comment on it. And
we're in those
warehouses
that got raided. Yeah,
we know there were a lot of arms in those warehouses because the officers that were thrown on the ground and robbed have since put out YouTubes in which they say that all their arms were stolen. So we don't know whether those arms were supplied by the U.S. or they were supplied by somebody else. But lots of arms were taken. And the rebels who stole them said they need to be at the front. And what are you guys keeping them here in warehouses back in the lines? You guys are the officers said that they were accused of being both kufr, unbelievers, as well as traitors. And they stole their underwear off them and their undershirts, all their clothes, everything that they owned. So it wasn't just the arms they were taking. And these were guys from the New Islamic Front that Liz was talking about, that has coalesced, a Salafi group that has coalesced now and is the most powerful single group in Syria, but still representing less than 50% of the fighters in Syria.
Liz, the raid on the warehouse, was that enough to change the balance of power among the rebel groups, or more like a symptom of the strength of the Islamic Front?
I think it's more of a symptom than a power balance changing thing. What you've got at the moment is an effort underway to merge the Free Syrian Army with the Islamic Front. That's been going on since October. The Islamic Front is trying to muscle its way into the FSA's Supreme Military Council because it is very worried about the peace negotiations coming up at Geneva. It doesn't want a deal to be done without it having a say there. So the FSA and the Islamic Front have been in merger talks, but the Islamic Front, being bigger than the FSA, is trying to kind of basically take it over. And the FSA is saying, no, we'll let you in on our terms, but you're not going to take us over. In the middle of this, the Islamic Front takes over the SMC's only warehouse of supplies in the north. And it's kind of like a way of saying, look, you guys don't have much choice but to deal with this because we can just knock you down any time we want, which is sort of what they're doing. But it's not it's more of a symbolic gesture than it is anything that's going to change anything on the ground.
Is the infighting among the rebels why the Syrian army has been able to have these recent military successes around Damascus and Aleppo?
Well, I think certainly I was up on the northern border when they had one of their bigger victories on the outskirts of Aleppo recently, and there's absolutely no question that all of the rebel groups were blaming infighting for what happened there. They were all trying to compete with each other to be the one who saved the day, and in the end, actually no group went in to save the day, and they lost this important strategic town. I think in Damascus, you've got a slightly different picture. You've kind of got three different situations going on in Syria. You've got the south, which is a separate story and is very interesting. You've got the north, where you have this showdown over the warehouses and that situation. And then around Damascus, you have a slightly different mix again. And I think that really the reason that the regime has been gaining ground there is that they are just militarily stronger. The opposition has a harder time getting supplies into Damascus. The regime is next to its base, its capital, which is the city of Damascus. And I think that's just a military balance of power thing that going on there.
You were just hearing from Liz Sly, who's the Washington Post bureau chief. She's speaking to us from Lebanon. I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. Next, I want to ask Josh Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at Oklahoma and author of the Syria Comment Blog. Josh, let's talk about al-Qaeda. We've presented these three rebel groups as being, you know, secular, quasi-Islamist, but then the third one is the al-Qaeda affiliated. Is it clear that the Islamic Front is in fact in opposition to Al-Qaeda? And is that really so important a distinction?
You know, this is where we get into trouble, is trying to draw clear distinctions between these three different groups, because they aren't clear distinctions. There's a rainbow, but they participate in, you know, the same funders who are funding the Islamic Front, this new Salafist powerhouse that's emerged. Many of them are also funding Al-Qaeda. And the Islamic Front has been working, most of the militias in the Islamic Front have been working hand in glove with Al-Qaeda in order to attack areas around into Latakia recently, the Manar Air Base, in Deraa in the south, they've been working hand in glove. And so this is the problem, is that they cooperate. They've kept an official separation because they know the Americans have proscribed Al-Qaeda. But they're working together, and they share arms, and they share duties. And usually Al-Qaeda provides suicide bombers and other things that and then on the ideological front, you know, often people say the big difference is Al-Qaeda wants a caliphate, and Islamic Front is Syrian nationalist. Right. But it's not so simple, because the leader of the Islamic Front, Zahran Alush, has made videos saying we want to resurrect the Umayyad Empire. That's the 8th century Islamic empire, which was based in Damascus. He's talked about ethnic cleansing of Alawites from Damascus. He tadhir, which is to purify the city of everything to do with Alawites. That's the ruling clique of these Shiite offshoot people, Assad and so forth. Very sectarian, very Islamist vision, which is different from Al-Qaeda, but different in degrees, and not connected so much to Iraq. But still, when he's asked what kind of government, he refuses to, you know, it's not democracy.
Yeah.
He says, we're going to get together a body of Islamic scholars, and they will tell us what the appropriate government is.
So they want to, so, you know, if the shorthand on Al-Qaeda is they'd like to return us to the 13th century in the caliphate, this guy would like to return us to, what, the 14th century or something?
Well, you know, he's using that as rhetorical as
yeah.
well. I mean, this is a device that he's using to, in order to express his credentials. And it's also a way of saying, I'm against Assad and against these new Saudis, these
right.
Alawites,
right.
who are his people.
And he's trying to rally people. And this speaks to, of course, when, you know, to get the ire of the populace up, these are definitely the tones you
yeah.
hit. It's called being a politician. Josh, I want to back up. Do you think, obviously the U.S. didn't have great choices, do you think the U.S. bungled either the execution of the funding, the very decision of who to fund? You know, is there anything differently the U.S. should have done in terms of picking or getting funds to these rebels?
You know, Obama had a very stark choice, which was to try to take charge of the Syrian opposition and make sure that pro-Americans won in Syria, or to really decide America can't pick the winners in Syria. And he chose the latter. And he's coming, of course, after Iraq and Afghanistan, where we spent trillions of dollars in Iraq. I think it's $3 trillion. And we spent tons of energy trying to pick winners. And we didn't do very well. And many pundits are saying if we'd only gone in stronger, more money, more arms, and picked the winners, we could have kept Syria from radicalizing. But, you know, we did that in Iraq. And
right.
in 3 weeks, we destroyed Saddam Hussein, and we handed the whole country over to the opposition. And then it radicalized. Everybody radicalized. And just this year, there's been over 7,000 political killings in Iraq. The civil war is still going on, you know, 11 years later. We could not stop it from radicalizing. And that's because both Syria, like Iraq, is very divided. And there's a terrible civil war raging that we can't control. And I think that Obama made the right decision. Now, it's right for America. It's probably bad for Syria. And many, you know, the tragedy is terrible. But could America have stopped this civil war? I don't think so.
Right. But then, you know, in Egypt and Libya, the U.S. wasn't, especially in Libya, somewhat in Egypt, not very active at all in picking who the next leaders would be. And that's kind of the opposite of Iraq and Syria. Perhaps all we could ever hope for is less bad leadership. I want to ask you, Liz Sly, about the human element and the refugees. You know, how dangerous is the situation with not only refugees leaving the country, but also just displaced people within Syria?
Well, yes, you have a terrible situation now. It's freezing all over the Middle East. There are, I think that, you know, there's pictures all over the television of snow in Cairo, and there's snow all across the Syrian cities, and lots of people are living without homes. They're living in fields. They're living in tents. I've heard reports today of children freezing to death inside Syria from just being outside and sleeping in the snow. You can only imagine what that's like, and it's happening here in Lebanon too, where you have very high ground, mountainous territory, and it's just blanketed in snow at the moment, and people are living in tents.
And so some numbers, UN estimates 2.3 million Syrians have fled to neighboring countries since March of 11. The other major issue is internal displacement. 6.5 million Syrians have fled their homes but remained in country. Europe, a total of 12,000 refugees have been taken in by EU members. The UK and Italy have offered no places at all. Why is that?
Well, I think people want to avoid a situation where they're inundated with Syrians. You've got, you've actually got 5 million, not 500,000 Syrians displaced inside Syria. 2.3 million living in the neighboring countries. Is Europe going to take in 7 million Syrians? I don't think so. And when are they going to go home? I mean, this war is not going to end. Nobody can see an end in sight to this war. I think that's one of the biggest tragedies of this situation. This is why it's not something... I think some of us who are watching this close up, I'm not sure you can take your hands off it, not because you don't want to take your hands off it. I mean, nobody who wants to get involved in this horribly messy, ugly situation. But at the same time, it's huge and it's not going to go away. Where does that lead? It really is quite incomprehensible when you start thinking about it.
Josh, given
you can't have 7 million people living outside in snow year after year after year.
Josh, given what we've been talking about, the fracturing of the rebels and this, and how Europe isn't taking in any of the refugees, and how it seems like the Assad military has gotten the upper hand, can we go back and say that Assad, give him points for vision, that when he agreed to get rid of his chemical weapons, he was getting the West off his back in the only way that was meaningful to them, and he kind of saw what would happen once he sidestepped the issue that the West really cared about? Did Assad play us all for fools a little bit?
You know, there's two different questions. You know, should we be giving Assad points? No. Were we foolish? Yes. I think that, you know, we don't really understand the depths of this struggle, and not in Iraq, not here. You know, unfortunately, you know, the Syrians are extremely divided, and there are people who are sticking with Assad because they believe their lives depend on it, and they might well depend on it. And he has killed, you know, as Liz was just describing, the humanitarian the fallout from this civil war is immense. Are we going to have to deal with Assad? I think we are going to have to deal. You know, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who's sort of the super State Department ambassador, said the other day, we have to talk to Assad because nobody knows, nobody's going to get rid of him. And most people in Washington today, most of the pundits and most of the, you know, policymakers are saying Assad has to go and we're going to have a transitional regime. And they're pumping papers out every day saying this kind of stuff. And it's not going to happen. You know, you shake your head when you read this stuff because you say, well, who's going to get rid of him? He's already said he's not going to step down. So the reality is that if we get to Geneva and have peace talks between rebels and regime folks, it's going to be very hard to convince him to leave Syria and to disband his regime. He's not going to do that. And that's the problem. And, you know, everybody is going to have to reduce their demands. Iran, which wants, I think, Assad to reconquer the country, and perhaps Russia wants that too, and the United States, which wants Assad to leave and this regime to be dismantled and a constitutional democracy to be built in Syria. And no one, and of course the Saudis want a Sunni victory over these Alawite Shiites who are allied with Iran. Nobody's going to get what they want. And the longer the international community that's funding most of this disagrees over the objectives, the longer Syrians are going to be driven into tents and have their houses destroyed, and the situation is going to go on. And that's where everybody has to reduce their demands.
What about, can pressure be applied through the Saudis, the Gulf states? You know, we talked about
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what's our allies, our major allies, are the Saudis in this affair. And as Liz said in the beginning, they're funding the opposite people to who we're funding. And so we're not on the same page, and we've got to get on the same page.
Liz, give us a look ahead to Geneva. If it is going to be in Geneva, these peace talks scheduled for, I think, January 22nd, I read that there was a watch convention in Geneva, and they might have to move to a nearby city. But what can we hope or expect from them in your estimation, Liz Sly?
I don't think we can expect very much from the beginning of this from this conference in January. However, that will be the beginning of a process. Everybody is now encouraging us to understand that Geneva could drag on for months. It could possibly drag on for years. I mean, we've had the Israeli-Palestinian peace talk for how long? That's been going on for years. So I think you need to think of Geneva as something that's just going to be the beginning of a process at which will eventually end the war, or which will probably be the process that ends the war. But when the war will end and how it will end is completely still up in the air, because as Joshua was saying, everybody's got to reduce their demands. Everybody's got to change their positions. At the moment, there is no common ground. There's no reason to believe any settlement is imminent. And the spectrum of opinions is so vast and wide, and the competition of different competing agendas and interests is so complicated and mixed up that there is no possible solution foreseeable at the moment.
Liz Sly is the Washington Post's Beirut bureau chief covering Syria. Joshua Landis of the University of Oklahoma writes the Serious Comment blog. Thanks to both of you very much.
It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
And up next, we will meet former assemblyman and new city council member Rory Lantzman. He recently wrote about Mike Bloomberg's legacy of bringing the private sector into government. And what do we do now that we no longer have a billionaire mayor? Stay with us.